Support for this public radio podcast comes from Lindblad Expeditions, exploring nature's wild, unspoiled places aboard its ships in partnership with National Geographic. Details at 1-800-EXPEDITION.
This is WFIU's Profiles. I'm delighted to welcome the celebrated opera singer and IU faculty member, Sylvia McNair.
Hello, Patrick.
Sylvia, it's wonderful to have you participating today in our chat. I thought we might talk a little bit about growing up.
Growing up?
Yeah,
let's
growing
talk
up.
About growing up, Patrick. Here's what I have to say about growing up.
Yes.
Why, oh, why, oh, why, oh, why did I ever leave Ohio? No, I'm totally joking.
But why did you ever leave Ohio?
To come to Bloomington, Indiana. No. I love it here.
Were your parents musicians?
Yes. My father did not make his living as a musician, but I've always said he was the real artistic soul in our household. My mother did make her living as a musician, and for 37 years, I can't even believe it, she taught music in the public schools, kindergarten through sixth grade. She did choral music primarily, but it was my father, and she was a pianist as well. In fact, it was my mother who put me on the piano bench when I was 3 years old, and we started trying to teach me how to play the piano.
Why did you say your father had the soul of a musician?
Well, my father, as I mentioned, did not make his living as a musician, but he was so sensitive and so in tune with the power of music. I mean, I remember I have a picture in my head right this minute practicing the first violin part for the Tchaikovsky Fourth Symphony for an orchestra concert at one point, and just listening to that piece of music on the record player. Oh, gosh, remember record players?
Yes.
Goodness sakes. You know, he could be moved to tears. He was an artistic soul, and he actually conducted himself. He was the music director at the church I was raised in, and at one point there were something like seven different choirs in that church: the children's choir, the teenage choir, the college choir, the three or four different adult choirs, you know, the ladies, the men's, the mixed, the whole thing. And he would often pay for orchestra musicians to come for special occasions at that church, pay for it right about out of his own pocket. He was an amazing guy.
Wonderful. Mm. What was the town?
Mansfield.
Mansfield, Ohio.
Ohio.
What's in Mansfield, Ohio?
One of the best things that's in Mansfield, Ohio is the First Congregational Church.
Yes.
Which is my home church and a place that's very, very dear to my heart. My mother is in Mansfield, Ohio. Lots of friends are in Mansfield,
good,
Ohio.
You mentioned the piano at three.
Yes.
You mentioned the violin.
I was seven when
at
I started
seven.
Taking violin lessons.
And then when did you begin to think of yourself as a singer? Let's leave even the opera singer till later. But when did you think of yourself as a singer?
Oh, I'm still working on that, Patrick. Am I really a singer? I actually went to college as a violin performance major. I wanted to pursue the violin professionally. It was a very wise violin teacher who actually said to me that I should take some singing lessons because he knew it would make me a better violinist. If I started dealing with breathing and phrasing as it relates to taking a good breath, mm-hmm, he knew it would make me draw the bow across the violin in a more sensitive way. Well, lo and behold, after about a year of those singing lessons, I realized I was having more fun practicing singing than I was practicing the violin. Hindsight being 2020, I think it's because I love words. And as a violinist, you don't get to wrap yourself up in great lyrics, and you don't get to taste the flavor of languages. Violinists are melody people. And the other great thing about singing, and I think, again, in hindsight, you can have eye contact with your audience when you're a singer. And all of those things, the words and eye contact and, you know, knocking down that invisible wall between the stage and the audience, all of that is, those are all things I love to do.
I once heard a great music teacher telling me that good students understand the architecture of the musical work. Does that make sense to you?
Architecture is something that I think about in almost every piece I sing.
Really?
Yes. More so now that I'm only doing musical theater and more popular kinds of jazz kinds of songs, because the architecture is how I start to memorize. By architecture, I guess I mean, let's just say in a standard Gershwin chorus or a Richard Rodgers chorus, a 32-bar chorus is a standard format, A-A-B-A, each of those getting 8 measures. That's the jumping-off point, because there are a million exceptions to that. But architecture is something that I live in all the time as a performer, and it's now something I'm teaching my students to think about as they learn music and memorize.
Is interpretation part of that architecture?
I don't think so. Architecture is, that's the first step. That's like first base. Let's call it first base.
So then you decided to come to IU. But where was your first degree from?
My first degree is from a small liberal arts college, which was the right place for me at the time, a college called Wheaton College.
Oh, I know Wheaton. It's a very good school.
Oh, thank you.
Near Chicago.
Yes.
Then you come to Indiana University.
Isn't that amazing?
You are part of a tradition of opera, and Virginia was your teacher, Virginia Zaiani. What do you convey in teaching, musically, but also personally? Because a great teacher is an example, is an inspiration. And I'm just wondering, what is it that you might have learned from Virginia? What is it that you might do differently?
One of the things that I try so hard to do in teaching my own students is that each person has his or her own vocal fingerprint, for lack of a better way to describe it. I don't think two singers should ever sound the same. Every singer should sound like an individual, because we are each individual human beings. And I try to make sure that my students sound like they sound. Therefore, I don't do a lot of demonstrating in the studio, because I don't want anybody trying to copy what I do or copy how I sing. I want Deandra to be Deandra. I want Ari to be Ari. I want Vasiliki to be Vasiliki and Ryan to be Ryan. I don't want them trying to sound like Sylvia.
That's good.
And the other thing that I emphasize, I think really first and foremost, is that singing should be fun. If we're not having fun doing it, let's go do something else.
That's a good point. I think it's true of anything in life.
Yes, it is. But, you know, that gets lost sometimes in the professional world, where everyone is so driven and ambition rules and success rules. And, you know, I would really rather be working in the B houses and having a ball than working in the A houses and having so much stress I can't sleep at night.
Mm-hmm. How do you prepare your students for a role, and how do you prepare yourself for a role?
I don't have any students that are singing roles.
But in principle.
I'm trying to get them to sing a song.
But how did you prepare for a role? How long did it take you?
Oh, it depends on the role.
Right
at this moment, something popped into my head. The very first time I had the assignment of the role of Susanna in The Marriage of Figaro.
Yes.
Whew, that is a big part, and it's a very aerobic part, on top of being difficult to sing. And, you know, it took me months to prepare, but here's how I did it. I got with a fabulous coach in New York, and she said, okay, Sylvia, get ready, because the role of Susanna in Mozart's Marriage of Figaro is one of the longest parts in the whole opera repertory. Here's how I suggest you do it. Learn the arias first. Learn the duets second, learn the trios third, learn the quartets fourth, and then learn the ensembles. And at some point in there, start weaving in, learning all the recitative, because there is so much recitative. So that's believe it or not, how I still do it.
Mm-hmm. I don't have a great memory, so I always have an enormous respect for people who do. And if I might return just once more to Virginia Zayani, once at a dinner, I asked her, how do you remember a role? And she said, you know, the minute I walk on the stage and I hear the first bar of music, it all comes back. Is that something opera singers have, that it's that combination of the music and the words and the role unfolds as you hear the music?
One of the ways that I learn is to dig into the text, probably to a fault. Some people might say I overdo my study of text and my involvement with the words. But, for example, going right back to Susanna and The Marriage of Figaro, one of the things I did was to handwrite every single word that Susanna speaks and that Susanna hears. I wrote it out on a legal pad like a play in Italian, and then underneath each Italian word, I translated it in English. So, even though the English doesn't always make sense when you do it that way, to my brain, I had a specific English word to go with every syllable of every word in Italian. It got so that when I was performing the role in Italian, it was incomprehensible to me that everybody in the room couldn't understand it as well as I knew it. That's how deeply I let it soak into me. So that's one of the ways I memorize, is to, I approach these things as plays first and as opera or singing second.
Is there any role in which you really felt you became the character?
Many. Thank you. I know that's incredibly immodest to say, and I apologize to our listeners for being so immodest, but there were roles that I just, you know, I woke up feeling like I had become her. Susanna, definitely one of them, because I sang so many productions of that opera. I think I became Poppea in The Coronation of Poppea, another opera I sang many, many times. Now, she's not a nice girl.
No.
She's not a very good person. In fact, she's a horrible person. You know, here's a woman who insists that her boyfriend, and of course it's an extramarital affair for starters, she insists that her boyfriend kill off his Secretary of State. She insists that he put his wife out to sea in a boat with no paddle. She's not a nice woman. But I so enjoyed acting that part that I just felt physically and mentally like for a little bit of time I became Poppea.
That's wonderful.
And, you know, when you've got Nikolaus Harnoncourt conducting your orchestra, you know, it just doesn't get any better than that.
But off stage, you were not like Poppea.
Goodness sakes, no.
No.
But, I mean, I loved acting her.
Yeah,
I loved acting
wonderful.
Her, and I felt when I was out there on stage with Philip Langridge singing the role of Nero, I was determined I was going to manipulate him and have exactly what I wanted.
Wonderful.
I loved it. That's... So, yeah, I became the good ones, and I became the bad ones.
You know, I'd like to talk a bit about your career, if I may. I always believe that some of the wonderful things that happen in our lives are not planned, that they come at fortuitous moments. And I was looking in your biography about the visit of Robert Shaw, who came to Bloomington to conduct a performance of the Bach B minor Mass, and you were the soprano soloist. Was that expected?
Oh, yeah. I'm speechless, which isn't a good thing on radio. Robert Shaw coming to Bloomington, Indiana in the fall of 1980 was perhaps the best piece of luck, of many, many huge pieces of luck that I enjoyed. But yes, Robert Porco chose me to be the soprano soloist for the Bach B minor Mass. Mr. Shaw was here. The B minor Mass, I think, was basically presented as a birthday present to Julius Herford. From that point, Mr. Shaw hired me to sing with him in so many places, in so much repertoire. I made my European debut with him. I made my first recording with him. I made my New York Philharmonic debut with him. it goes on and on and on. I have often said I would be pouring coffee in upstate New York if it weren't for Robert Shaw.
Wonderful.
Yeah, to say I am grateful is the understatement of the millennium.
Would this be a point for us to hear a bit of the Bach B minor Mass?
Thank you.
'82 was a great year for you, too. I was looking, and you won the Metropolitan Opera National Council auditions. You made a London concert debut, and you received a Grammy nomination for Poulenc's Gloria. Tell me more.
Isn't that unbelievable?
It is.
My very first recording, I actually was nominated. I didn't win, but I was nominated for a Grammy.
It was exciting. And the Metropolitan, I think of our students who go to the Metropolitan Opera auditions. And what was your experience like? Was it intimidating to
walk? It's overwhelming. Intimidating, terrifying, overwhelming. Yes. Well, in 1982, they were still doing the National Metropolitan Opera auditions in a manner such that all 11 finalists were considered winners, and I put that in quotes. They didn't pare it down any further than the 11 finalists. I'm sure I would not have made the top two or the top five because I was not one of the stars in that pack of 11. But I did make it to the pack of 11, and that's all the further the competition went in that particular year. They've changed it since, as you well know. But it was overwhelming. In fact, I remember in the final concert, I believe the aria I sang was from the opera Manon by Massenet, mm-hmm. which I got to do for the very first time in my life here at Indiana University. But I also was programmed to sing the letter duet from Act Three of The Marriage of Figaro with my pal Nancy Gustafson singing The Countess, and I was singing Susanna. So, of course, I'm the one that had to actually do the writing of the letter and the holding of the letter as we proofread it, singing Sull'aria. I was shaking so badly. That letter, I mean, it was ridiculous. Standing on the stage of the Metropolitan Opera is overwhelming and so terrifying.
I'm in awe of people who are soloists standing on the stage of the Metropolitan Opera. Gee, that must take nerves of steel.
And I do not have nerves of steel, Patrick. Let me be real clear about that. But I will confess this. There was not one performance that I sang in that opera house, and I only did four seasons, but that's four seasons more than a lot of people get. And I don't know how many performances in those four seasons. I kind of lost count, so enough that I lost count, I suppose. There was never one performance that I didn't stand there and think, oh, my gosh, this is the Met.
And what did that do to you?
Well, it's...
It didn't frighten you, though.
It did frighten me, but not so badly that I didn't survive it. But it's a very big place. I mean, just physically, it's a very
right.
big opera house. And I don't have a big voice. You know, that's why I was never one of the big Met stars. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was there singing Mozart and Handel and Britten and Stravinsky. I mean, I wasn't there singing the big rep. I don't have a big voice for that house. But it's an enormous thing, both literally and figuratively.
Mm-hmm. You've had some good conductors, some great conductors that you've worked with. Leonard Slatkin,
yes.
Seiji Osawa,
yes.
Kurt Mazur. What's the interaction between the singer and the conductor. I'm sure there are many of our listeners who'd really like to know, what is the ideal relationship between a soloist and a conductor? What is that connection, and what does a conductor do that's a great conductor? I assume you've never had a bad conductor.
Oh, I think I probably have, but I can't remember any of their names. But I will say this. One of the things I am extremely grateful for in my career is that I have worked with a lot of amazing conductors. Maybe I've had those opportunities because I have so many years of instrumental playing in my background, and I think that has affected how I sing. I sing like instrumentalists play, and I think conductors respond to that. I think conductors like singers who are good musicians. But to answer your question, I've always said the best conductors are the conductors who continue to perform themselves, whether it's on the piano or the cello or singing, because it gives them an extra sympathy for what the soloist is going through. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know that Seiji Ozawa and Kurt Mazur and Leonard Slatkin and Robert Shaw and on, I don't know that they, you know, have performed recently in public, but they are conductors who seem to understand. Claudio Abbado, there's another one. Yeah. I worked with him a lot. Nikolaus Harnoncourt, John Elliott Gardner, I worked with him a lot. They understand something about the singing mechanism, the breathing, the connection with text, the connection with audience. Without getting any more technical than that, André Previn, I worked with him a lot as well. They know how to give. Jimmy Levine, he's almost, you know, that's why he's so successful in opera. He knows how to give a singer the space to breathe and phrase and sing.
Sylvia, you've sung in different contexts and on different stages. You've sung in big opera houses and on major concert halls. But you've also had some special concerts. For example, you sang the Bach B minor Mass for Pope John Paul II. You performed for the U.S. Supreme Court with Sandra Day O'Connor and the other justices. And you've also sung for Hillary Clinton in Salzburg. Interesting people, interesting context.
Yes.
Let's talk a bit about them.
Well, I'll start with the Pope. Although I'm not Catholic, that was another performance that felt like an enormous honor to be a part of. And I'll tell you how that came about. The Austrian embassy decided they wanted to give the Pope a birthday present. So they sent the Vienna Philharmonic and a group of soloists and a wonderful chorus called the Arnold Schönberg Chor from Vienna to the Vatican to do a concert. It was in June of the year 2000. He turned 80 that year. I think it was a birthday gift from the Austrian embassy. And I was lucky enough to be chosen as the soprano soloist for that. Riccardo Muti conducted. And I have a photograph, which is one I treasure. I can't even describe it, of actually shaking the hand of Pope John Paul II, being introduced to him by Riccardo Muti.
And was this in the Vatican itself?
Yes.
In one of the reception halls? Or?
It was in that concert hall, which seats 7,000 people.
Oh, where
people,
he receives people.
Where he receives people, exactly.
Yes, for audiences.
So 7,000 of his closest friends were invited to that performance. It was broadcast live all over Europe on television, so there were television cameras and lights everywhere, and it was an amazing event. And I had two friends who flew over from New York to be there for that performance.
Wonderful.
Very, very exciting.
Now, what about the Supreme Court?
Okay.
Do they appreciate music?
Well, this is fun. Sandra Day O'Connor and her husband, John O'Connor, had heard me sing a concert in Washington, D.C. with the National Symphony Orchestra. I think I sang a concert with the orchestra of Handel and Mozart arias. Neville Mariner was conducting. I do remember that. And Sandra Day O'Connor went back to the court and, you know, they had in place at that time a concert series. Now, series is stretching it slightly because there was only one concert per year on this concert series. But in any case, she was in charge that year and she called Steve Strickland, who was administrating the series of one concert a year, and said, see if you can get Sylvia McNair to come sing for us. I think the reason they had these concerts is that they did decide that the one thing all nine of them could agree on is that they all loved music.
Good.
So
that's hopeful.
There we were in the East Room or the West Room at the Supreme Court. But I've become friends with Sandra Day O'Connor. She's had me sit with her in her chambers and taken me on a tour of the whole building. And it was a very, very exciting thing to do.
And then Salzburg with Hillary Clinton.
Yes. That was the summer that Chelsea was college shopping and Bill was, I don't know, doing something with G8. And Hillary and Chelsea came to Salzburg. I was one of the artists in the Salzburg Festival that summer. It was 97, I think. So they asked me to sing for her, and I sang a lot of fun stuff. And at the end of the little program, she came running up to me, and she said, oh, would you like to come to the White House, and would you give me singing lessons? I'm tone deaf. So in any case.
Maybe we should talk about roles, because they've been such a range.
Yeah.
In Idomeneo, you sang Ilia, and True Love in the Rake's Progress, Pamina in the Magic Flute, and I'm running through all of these, Rosina in the Ghost of Versailles, Titania in Midsummer Night's Dream. Gee, what a range.
Well, there are also operas that no one produces. Maybe that's why I'm unemployed.
I went to one of the premier performances of the Ghost of Versailles at the Metropolitan.
Yeah.
Was that a difficult opera?
I had the best role in the opera, so for me it was an easy learn. I mean, it was, you know, not difficult at all because I sang the role of Rosina, who has great melodies. It's a difficult opera, but Rosina's music is simple and beautiful.
Difficult to stage as well, do you think?
It wasn't difficult with Colin Graham in charge.
Yes, that's
my hero.
What about Anne Trulove?
That's harder.
Do you like Anne Trulove?
I do. She's a goody-goody, but I like her a lot. And I did The Rake's Progress a lot of times and enjoyed doing it every single time.
Were any of these more demanding than others?
Well, each role has its hurdles, its special hurdles, sure.
Yeah. You know, I've also been intrigued by the wonderful Oak Room at the Algonquin and the Rainbow Room.
Yes.
And, of course, Cabaret and Broadway. You started off as an opera singer. Now, popular music, and I don't think this is really just popular music. This is really great music.
It sure is.
What about a shift to sing this? I've often listened to opera singers who don't make that transition. You make it beautifully.
I have often said, Patrick, that I had to learn how to sing opera. This kind of music, the theater music, just falls out of me.
It does.
I just can't help it. It just falls out of me. I feel like it's what I was born to sing.
Well, I wonder whether this wouldn't be a good point for us to have an excerpt from perhaps one of your performances of popular music. Tell me more about the differences between recordings and live performances. Is it easier to do a recording? You can do a second take and a third take. There's no returning after you've sung an aria on the stage.
No, there's not. You know, artists discuss this a lot. Yes, it is true that when you're making a recording, you can go back and do it again to get it right, in the same way that photographers like to touch up photographs because it's a still piece and it's going to be there for close examination for a long, long time. I think that's the principle behind striving for perfection on an audio recording.
Yes.
It's going to be there. It's going to be listened to over and over and over and over again. It's worth taking away as much of the imperfection and as many of the flaws as possible. I happen to love recording. I love the microphone. I'm very comfortable singing with the microphone. I like being able to focus on the task at hand without also trying to fill up the concert hall. And that's, for me, the it kind of makes you have to be a hybrid in a sense, because when you're performing live, you have to think about the guy up in the balcony who paid a lot of money for that seat. Mm-hmm. And sometimes projecting and emoting for the larger space means that what goes into the microphone isn't quite what you wish it was.
That's a good point. Let's talk about life in Bloomington.
Oh, yes.
But let's start a little earlier, because some of us actually remember you as an announcer on WFIU in the early 1980s.
Broadcasting at 103.7 FM, this is WFIU Bloomington, Indiana.
That was a good experience.
It was terrific. It was terrific. I love radio because you don't have to worry about a good hair day.
And also, it was an opportunity to deal with a lot of interesting music and other things.
Interesting music, interesting news. I love radio. I couldn't do it now because it's, you know, I'm such an idiot when it comes to tech.
Now you've come back to the school where you studied. What's that like, coming back? Is the school different? Is there a different feel? Are you glad to be with students? You know, I'm a university administrator, but I'm also a teacher. And if I could digress for a moment, every day when I go and teach, I still have stage fright.
Do you?
A little. But 3 hours afterwards, when the class is over, it's the most exhilarating experience. So I'm wondering if you share that with me.
You've touched on so many things that I'd love to talk about. Because I'm middle-aged now, I won't be able to remember the fourth and fifth points by the time I've finished talking about one and two. But in any case, to address your point about coming back to Bloomington, I really was worried about that, Patrick. I really was worried that it would feel like I was coming back. I now see that I have come forward to Bloomington. Yes, I moved my things, quote unquote, back to Bloomington, but this was not back. This was forward. And that feels really, really good.
And in many ways, is the classroom as challenging as a live performance on a stage?
It's different. It's yeah. Apples and oranges. It's chalk and cheese. But I understand what you mean about being a little bit nervous up in front of hypercritical students, although they're not the New York Times or the London Times, you know, criticizing you. But they are very smart and they know a lot and they know that they're talented. And yeah, it can be a little nerve-wracking. And yes, it is very exhilarating, especially when it goes well.
Yeah, that's what the excitement of teaching
Absolutely.
Is.
And I'll tell you something else, and I want to be very clear about this. Teaching is the best teacher. Teaching is the best teacher. And I think in my own performances now that I'm traveling around and doing, I honestly think I'm doing some of the best singing of my life at age 50. I'm doing some of the best singing of my life because I'm doing what I'm teaching.
And it changes
And it works.
You.
And it changes you. A lot of things have changed me, of course. There aren't any secrets in my life. I'm a cancer survivor, and that
yes.
has changed me enormously. But just teaching itself, teaching is the best teacher.
Let me ask you about young people and music, so-called classical music. There's so many articles one reads about audiences being middle-aged. We've got to do more to attract young people into the concert halls and into the opera. But on a campus like this, that's really not an issue, because I look around at every time I go to a concert or an opera and I'm surrounded by young people. But is it an issue nationally?
I think it is. And I don't have good answers. I don't envy the general directors and artistic directors of these opera companies and symphony orchestras. I think the big organizations will be fine. The New York Philharmonic, the Chicago Lyric Opera, the Chicago Symphony, Ravinia, the Philadelphia Orchestra, the Boston Symphony, the Met. They will be fine. They will survive. I think, frankly, what Peter Gelb is doing at the Metropolitan Opera is nothing short of brilliant. I know it's controversial. I know people are throwing knives in his back all the time. But he is trying to bring that opera house into the 21st century with the addition of HDTV and music videos and putting operas in movie theaters. You know, I know people hate change. Change is uncomfortable, but we have to change. Everything else is changing. We've got to keep up.
And it is reaching out to new audiences.
And it is reaching out to new audiences. From a performer's point of view, what I can say is I have watched over my own career of 25 years now. Good grief. But I feel that my job as a performer is to connect to my audience. And it's true now more so than ever. If I'm not reaching across and connecting with somebody in the audience, connecting with their eyes, connecting with their hearts, connecting with their souls, then I have failed. And if we can manage to do that, if we can figure out how to do that, whether that means we have to change the songs, as I did, as I chose to do, or change whatever, we have to figure out how to show people that they can have a few minutes of peace and a few minutes of respite from all the things that are stressing them out, because music is so healing and so life-giving.
You know, you mentioned that you were a cancer survivor, and you've spoken openly about this. Many people have appreciated hearing from you about how you faced these challenges over the past months. You've gone beyond a matter of concern. You've seen this almost as a purposeful mission, haven't you, to talk about this and to be open about it?
Well, I've said many times that if my journey with cancer can't be put to good use to help somebody else, then it was all a big waste of time. I want to talk about it. There is nothing about my now year and a half long cancer journey that is a secret. It's all right out there in the open. And that's fine with me. I'm choosing to do that. I have had many surgeries, 6 at last count, months of chemotherapy, radiation, physical therapy. My body is forever altered. My spirit is forever altered. And the way I have decided to deal with it, sometimes it's as silly as going and buying a new wig when you're bald. Sometimes it's as silly as when I get scared, I throw a dinner party. The scarier cancer gets, the more parties I throw. I have a photo album full of cancer photos, dinner parties and head shaving parties and all kinds of things. The scarier it gets, I just throw another party because I don't know how else to do it without losing my mind.
But also, in a way, it's an existential choice, isn't it? It's living in the moment and not allowing the illness to take the moment away from you.
Well, I've said from the start that I'm in denial. I'm not sure it's really denial I'm in because I do show up for my appointments. What I definitely am in is a state of refusal. I refuse to let this disease knock me over. It has knocked me over many times, but I just keep getting back up because I refuse to let this evil, evil disease knock me flat.
You've put all your energy, your creativity, your stamina that you've learned in your career into your health at this point.
Maybe that's what it is. I mean, I don't deny the fact that there is an element of performance in the way I'm choosing to live with cancer. There is an element of performing it, performing looking good, performing being happy, performing living well. And yeah, performance, being a performer, has definitely helped me stand up and smile and try to look as good as it's possible to look when you're bald and wear adorable baseball caps and fabulous-looking green wigs and pink wigs, and I have two peroxide blonde wigs and two brown wigs, and my wig repertoire is stunning.
And I'm assuming that Bloomington, Indiana is a nurturing community.
Oh, it's incredible. I'm so happy to be here. I have a medical community that takes such great care of me. We've all become friends. We dine out together, and they all come to my parties, and we're all on a first-name basis, and I'm very, very blessed and lucky to be under the care of these great doctors and nurses and technicians.
Sylvia, it's been inspiring but also a delight to talk with you today.
Thank you, Patrick.
I thought we might want to close maybe with something joyful, maybe Mozart at this point.
Love it if you would close with De Vieni Non Tardar.
Oh, yes.
From Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro. This is recording with the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields and Neville Mariner conducting.
And that's a wonderful choice. Thank you so much for finding the time to be here.
Thank you, Patrick.
This is Profiles on WFIU, and I am Patrick O'Mara.
The program you just heard was recorded in May of 2007. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Emily McCord was our research assistant. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. More information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website at wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.